When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This podcast is sponsored by Talkspace. May is Mental Health Awareness Month, and Talkspace, the leading virtual therapy provider, is encouraging people to talk it out in therapy. By talking or texting with a supportive, licensed therapist at Talkspace, you'll gain insights, discover truths, and experience breakthroughs that will improve how you live and how you feel. With Talkspace, just answer a few questions online, and you'll be matched with a therapist. And because you'll meet your therapist online, you don't have to take time off work or arrange childcare. You'll meet on your schedule, whenever you feel most at ease. Plus, Talkspace works with most major insurers, and most insured members only pay a $25 copay or less. No insurance? No problem. If you want to make progress toward a mentally healthier place, Talkspace is here for you. Now get $80 off your first month with promo code SPACE80 when you go to Talkspace.com. Match with a licensed therapist today at Talkspace.com. Save $80 with code SPACE80 at Talkspace.com.
Welcome, everybody, to Spark My Muse. I'm your host, Lisa Colon de Lay. And today we have a returning guest on. I'm so happy to have Casey Tigret on to go over his book, The Gift of Restlessness, Spirituality for Unsettled Seasons. Casey's also a spiritual director and a podcast host of the Otherwise podcast. Casey, thank you for being my guest again today.
It is my good and true pleasure.
So I wanted to speak a little bit about, before we jump into the book, speak a little bit about what got you to write this book. Sometimes we write books that we wish we had, or sometimes we write the books that we need to read. And what brought this book about in your mind?
Yeah, I think it fits the descriptions you just gave. Some of it was trying to make sense of my own experience. Some of it fit in the category of, I didn't know that I thought this until I wrote it down. So sometimes getting that out of your mind and into a digital or otherwise page, you suddenly realize, oh, this has been in there the whole time. I didn't know that. The interesting piece about this book is that I wrote a version of it early in 2019, and then it just went in a digital drawer. And so it just sat for almost a year. Did the publishing, pitching, nobody bought, whatever, and just put it away and said, well, maybe we'll come back to this later. It was an interesting exercise. And then 2020 hit. And as much as I tried really hard with this book that it would not be a quote-unquote pandemic book, I don't know how any of us tell meaningful stories going forward without at least the events of 2020, whether that was the pandemic or the political situation or, you know, whatever universal things we all experienced, without that being at least the backdrop. But I know that it definitely shaped the stories that I was thinking about, the experiences that I had from the universal, like, what are we all going through as a big human adventure? But also there were some particular stories for myself and my family that really went right to the heart of this concept of restlessness. And so the book that was changed because it was now informed by a whole new set of narratives. And so I think that's, it reminded me that writing is working with a living document. Because as much as writing is putting life and experience and faith and doubt and ideas on a page, it's also knowing that those things are alive in and of themselves. So it's not an autopsy, but you're working with a living thing, And that living thing can grow and evolve. And so that's part of the reason I was writing the book, was not only to make sense of my own restlessness that I've always had, but also then to say, now we have some very pointed, significant, intense stories that revolve around the theme.
Yeah. I think we're talking about, sometimes with writing, we're talking about an extension of ourselves, and we are a living document ourselves. It's how we can process, and also we are ever changing and, you know, in flux. And so that's winds up being this thing we share with other people too, that reflects that in themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You're always connecting with someone else's. I feel like, especially writing in the areas of spirituality, spiritual formation, I'm always connecting with someone else's evolution, someone else's transformation, wherever they might be on a particular arc. I'm always writing in order to meet them along the road, wherever they might be, and making sense of my own life helps to give something to them that they may not have had otherwise. At least I hope so.
Right. Now, you sent your book, a copy of your book, to me, and I wrote an endorsement or a reflection about it, you could say, and this is what I'll read it, because it kind of encapsulates how I felt about the book. And as I have gone and reread it again for this interview, like a little closer and dug into some parts more than others, it becomes even more meaningful, because I wanted to dig into some things about belonging and some other stuff. So what I wound up writing about your book was that, with the gift of restlessness, Casey Tigert sends wisdom into the center of our funk. Seasons of sadness, discontent, or ennui are among the most common human experiences. And spiritual director Casey reflects tenderly on the essential questions that this restlessness propagates within us. They pertain to belonging, purpose, provision, healing, and protection. Then he guides us back to our own belonging. For the troubled heart, learning this cartography and finding practices that guide and heal us is a must. Well done.
The center of our funk.
The center of our funk.
I love that.
Right. So that's what I felt like your book, how it spoke to me, is that a lot of times we don't know exactly what's wrong, but we feel like something's wrong. We feel like we're not where we need to be, or they're just, you know, what is that? Is it a funk? What is that? And so we need some wisdom to speak into that. And we need to know that that's normal, to be restless, to have restless seasons, and that there are gifts we can find from that. And I also wanted to ask, this is, I'm not sure how familiar you are with it. If this line of conversation doesn't work, I can always edit it out. But I wound up thinking a lot about restlessness as it relates to the afflicting thought that Evagrius speaks about and others speak about, called acedia. And I was wondering if that... If you encountered that at all as you were writing this, thinking about acedia, which is sort of, it was just often described as spiritual discontent or the opposite of spiritual joy, kind of low energy or listlessness, which can be kind of debilitating or like sometimes felt like a boredom. And how do you, if you do, how do you compare what you call restlessness with acedia?
Wow. I haven't done much with that, but what I do know of it is I think what it does is it expresses the fact that one of the challenges I felt writing this book was helping people feel like restlessness was something normal, really to try and help people normalize it, because beginning with the normalization of restlessness and saying, yes, what it says is if you are a living, breathing human being, you are going to experience seasons of restlessness. It's part of just being alive. Mm-hmm. And what acedia does, I think, is it helps to expand the practicalities of where that shows up. And so the idea of acedia, when it connects with something like deconstruction and reconstruction, sometimes they can be catalysts for each other. And the question is always how to find that fine line between abiding in the middle of something and getting stuck forever in it. to me, the challenge of restlessness is that same line. It's how do you embrace what this is without getting completely stuck in it forever? Because our typical reaction to restless seasons is it kicks in the survival mechanism. So we want to fight or flight. Even for the sake of, if you acknowledged certain people along certain stages of the spiritual journey, if they acknowledge the acedia in their own life, like a spiritual boredom, there is a kind of fight or flight response that kicks in. We're like, well, I just need to try harder. So I work with people in spiritual direction who they'll say, you know, I feel far from God. So I extended my time in the morning, it usually goes to practices. Like I'm just trying really hard to fight through this season. And that's not always a terrible idea, but sometimes we're being welcomed into that. And I think more often than not, we're being welcomed into that restlessness because there's something there we wouldn't have or we wouldn't be able to receive if it weren't for that unsettled, irritated space where in the book I talk about, it's the place where we can't go back to the way things were. And yet we have no idea what it means to move into the future. And we're sort of cemented in the present tense. So that's a person whose marriage has ended, or they've said the thing. They said what they were thinking without thinking about what they were saying. And now that word is out there and you can't take it back. And so everything has changed, but no idea what's going to look like going forward. And so we just sit in that sort of uncomfortable present tense. And I think acedia can welcome you into that. For acedia to really exist, it means that there was a time when it wasn't that way. For someone to feel forsaken means there was a time where they felt unforsaken, where they felt cared for or loved. And so restlessness also highlights the fact that we were at a place that was not this one, and we would love to go back there, but that just isn't possible. So I could see some overlaps. I'd love to explore that more. Maybe that's in the sequel, The Gift of Restlessness 2, you know.
Yeah, acedia is also one. I hesitated to bring it up because acedia is not this commonly used word. It's a little esoteric, but because I've looked it up a lot and for my book and for my work, and it has really clarified things for me that these certain kinds of funk have been acedia for me and for many others, and we didn't know it. And it's normal. It's part of how we are spiritually formed and how our spiritual path comes about, you know, how we journey through on the spiritual path. And the normalizing of it, like you're doing with restlessness, it helps take the teeth out of it. It makes it not pathological, which is something I'm hoping people in spiritual direction, spiritual companioning continue to do, because there's such a push from the therapy wing, which is like every dilettante on Instagram right now is a therapist all of a sudden. If everything turns into therapy, then you have a lot of pathology all over the place and you don't have any thing that seems like, well, there's also something as normal human experience, which includes terrible sadness too, and terrible, sometimes terrible despondency, but that's all mixed into the human experience. And we just don't like it. So it seems like must be pathology.
Well, the growing conversations about resilience, I'm seeing that word quite a bit more about resilience, developing resilience. And some of it is coming from, is reactionary towards, it's generational, feeling like, oh, these kids are not resilient, or they haven't developed their ability to withstand blank or blank. And so, okay, that's an aspect of it, but more so the ability to sit with situations that are not ideal and simply not try and fight them, not give up, but be actively present. And that's why in the book, the image that makes the most sense for me is Jesus in the wilderness. Because there is this, you know, from a Christian perspective, there is a modeling, a mapping that we see in Jesus for times when wilderness times are when all of our normal coping mechanisms, our ways of understanding the world and God and self and others, have been stripped away. And so to sit in that wilderness space, and what Jesus does is rejects all the ways that he could have solved it. So the therapies are, you know, to your point about therapy, it's diagnose, treat, you know, a lot of times, not everybody, that's painting with a very broad brush, but there are, you find the pathology, you diagnose it, you find a way of treatment. And that is good. And I believe deeply in the impact therapy has had on me and members of my family. But there are also times when everything gets stripped away, and it's not so much something that needs to be diagnosed as it is something that just needs to be sat with. And so Mark's account of Jesus in the wilderness, he says that Jesus was with the wild beasts and the angels attended to him. And I just find that so powerful. It's the place between the things that could destroy us and the things that will ultimately bless and rescue us. And instead of running to one or the other, Jesus remains in between. And so I think that's a model for how you can't find the gift in restlessness if we're not willing to stay there for a little bit.
I love how you say that. I think you're absolutely right. It's knowing that, realizing that, thinking that, and then actually doing it, actually believing it in a way that you live it out as though it were real. That's the key. And I think that, you know, in my head, I can go, absolutely. And then when I get my opportunity or my test, I'll be like, no way.
Practically.
Maybe next time.
Like Casey Tigert and that silly book.
He's so right, but that's hard.
Why did we have to talk about this? I would have been so much better off not having known that.
Oh, well, there was something I wanted to bring up about. I love in the book how you talk about belonging, and I wanted to do a little bit of a deep dive. In Seasons of Restlessness, you write that belonging is often at the center of our quandaries. And I wanted to see if we could converse about that a little bit. You write on page 44 that belonging to ourselves is a way of loving ourselves. And that really, just reading that kind of puts me at ease, because I've been thinking about all the ways, like, how do we love others if we're never really loving ourselves? How do we belong to others when we don't belong to ourselves? And these are the thoughts I've been kind of rolling over in my mind. And maybe you can speak a little bit to this idea of belonging as it ties into restlessness.
Yeah. Gosh, I guess the place where it always starts for me is just hearing people talk about that, and hearing people talk about belonging, especially over the course of life changes. So when someone moves from a house full of kids to an empty nest, there is a sense in which that way of life, the busyness, the activities, the parenting that becomes coaching, and that gives them a sense of belonging. I belong to this particular work, these particular people. The way they read their sacred text changes. The way they, you know, the way a father sees the word father changes, and they belong to a different way of understanding God. There are metaphors that make more sense. And so I hear people moving from one stage to another, and there's a spiritual crisis. Like, who am I if I don't have this? Belonging to ourselves is even harder, because in some Christian theology, self is the enemy. And the idea of that humanity is totally depraved and there's nothing good you can do, what it does is it causes us to live at odds with ourselves. And it causes disintegration. Because we would want to distance ourselves from something that is frail and broken and ultimately evil. But what that also leads to is it can lead to a hatred of ourselves. I've not met a person who can live out a really healthy spiritual journey who hates themselves. And so belonging to yourself is not saying I'm good enough, I'm smart enough, and doggone it, people like me. But it is more welcoming what Richard Rohr talks about in one of the later stages of spirituality as I am who I am, warts and all. It's being able to have a non-dual approach to I am the person, I am capable of great good, and I'm also capable of falling apart and wounding other people. And so that becomes a really key move in how we love other people. Because if that's true of us and we can see it as true of other people, we see it quicker in other people. Like I can see in somebody else where they're blowing it, especially if them blowing it affects me. But when I acknowledge that about myself, then I have to say, okay, we stand on level ground, you and I. We're both capable of great good and great darkness. And so let's start from there with the conversation. So that's in the book, I talk about that as a little b belonging. So there's a lowercase b belonging and an uppercase b belonging. And this works much better if you can see them. So we'll just try and do this auditorily, but it looks better if you can actually see the words. But there is an uppercase b belonging that is always true. That is always, no matter what stage of life we're in, no matter where we are geographically, you know, you and I talking about your return to Puerto Rico, no matter where you are geographically, there is a big B belonging, an uppercase B belonging that's always true. And from my perspective, it is that we are created as very good. And that is something that the divine creates us all as very good and never goes back on that. We're never not called very good. We are fearfully and wonderfully made. So there's a beauty in the design, but also a wonder and a goodness and a hopefulness, even in the midst of some great darkness. And that we're all called beloved. Like that's our nature and our identity. And so that uppercase B belonging is always true. And that shapes for us how we relate to God and to self and to others. But there are lowercase belongings, lowercase b belongings that shift and change over life. There are beliefs and metaphors I have about God now that I did not have when I was in my 20s and that I didn't have when I was in my 30s. But because of stages of life, because of stages of spirituality, those little b belongings change. God, the divine has not changed. My way of seeing the divine has changed. And where people struggle with that kind of belonging is usually because they see the metaphor or the image as equal to the thing. So when you come to the point where you realize, I cannot live with God as warrior anymore, if that identity and belonging to God or of community of faith has been shaped around that, there is a crisis that happens. And what's gone on there is the image I like to use is we've mistaken the telescope for the stars. This is just a way of us seeing and a way of us forming early belongings and identity. And so belonging to ourselves is noticing who we are. I was talking to a friend today and we were talking about preaching, and that's something that I get to do from time to time. And he said, what have you learned? And I said, well, when I was younger, I was arrogant enough to believe I could ad-lib most of it and it would be fine. And I said, now I realize you are not that good and you need to write things down because number one, I have a bit more self-knowledge. Number two, people are going to take what you say and actually do something with it. You are stewarding something great. And so learning those things about ourselves, our propensity to feel like we're indestructible or over-exaggerating our ability to do certain things, all of those that go into growth and development, if we can just step into the restlessness of saying, I'm beloved by God, fearfully and wonderfully made, and also I have a propensity to blow up my own, you know, overstate my own importance. And those two things can be held together at the same time. And sometimes that comes about because of pain, because of failure, that makes us realize that truth about ourselves. And when we embrace it, we're like, well, I can't go back to the moment before that, before I blew it, before I failed, before I caused this pain or experienced this pain. But now I have to go forward and I have no idea what that looks like. So what does it look like for me to be a father, a husband, a brother, a communicator, a leader, a writer, now that I've learned this particular thing about myself? And how do I receive the gift that comes, the gift of wisdom, insight, resiliency that comes with just being a part of that? I have no idea if I answered your question, Lisa. I know we went places. I'm not sure if it was helpful, though.
It was a journey. it's all good. Yeah, I like how you talk about kind of what happens when we're youthful and what we're like. I think I heard that confidence is what you have before you know better. And
yes,
it's like before you have all the information, there's something to be said for you know, when you don't know what you're doing, you can be confident. When you start to learn more deeply and have more wisdom, then you realize the responsibility you have and that you were way in over your head. But I wanted to speak a little bit, just coming back to the tradition in Christianity of mortifying the flesh and denying self, and how that can really work against, just like as you were saying, there's this struggle that happens, this denying of self and kind of the mortifying of the flesh is an interesting like kind of turn of phrase, because how do you belong to something that you've erased or mortified or gotten rid of? And that really works into how, at least in Western Christianity, how embodiment is so hard, and we have Christianity becomes this thing we think in our heads, and you know, about doctrine and belief mainly, and how do we get out of this framework where it's Christianity is often what you believe or the thoughts that are in your head, instead of being this completely integrated organism. And so being, like you were saying, being a consistent, grounded, loving person is difficult or impossible if you are not truly belonging and loving of yourself. But if you've been hating yourself because you're a sinful person that is mortifying the flesh because the flesh is so disgusting and sinful, you're at odds. And I think that this has been a struggle for a lot of people I've seen written different ways, and people struggling with how do I make these two competing concepts work? How do they integrate into a wholesome spiritual formation? This has kind of been the conundrum, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. And I don't know that, gosh, I don't know that there's much of an easy answer. The way that I'll just give my, and I could be wrong and probably am about 50% of this, but as I've approached the idea of mortifying, when I look at that word, the study I've done on it is that the heart of mortifying is to choke off and to restrict. And when I think about that as it relates to something like our mortifying the desires or mortifying the body, mortifying the flesh, it seems to have the sense of cutting off a certain amount of power and vitality. And in our younger, when I look at human development and map it onto spiritual development, it's funny how those tracks run parallel. Because for a lot of our early life, you know, you look at an infant does not choke off the power of their bodies. Their body rules. So their mood is determined by the way they feel. If they are soiled, they're going to let you know. If they're hungry, they're going to let you know. If they're, you know, the body calls all the shots. As we grow up, we learn how to take those bodily impulses and sort of put them in their proper context. For the most part, sometimes we don't, but we learn how to not give them so much power. And that's how, you know, we're talking to our daughter about, I just feel terrible. I don't want to go to school today. Okay. There's going to be a moment where you have a job. And you're not going to have any sick days left. And you're going to have to figure out what to do with that bodily impulse so that you can do the rest of your life. And so there's that growth and development. And I think it's the same arc that we have in our spiritual development, is that our body really drives a lot of our early human, our early spirituality. What do I do with myself? Where do I place myself? This community, these people, these practices. And over time, we learn how to hold intention. Teachings like, you know, your body is evil and sinful, and the sometimes what gets passed off as Christianity, that's really just Gnosticism, that we're supposed to escape our bodies, and that's the ultimate goal of spirituality. But I love what Richard Foster said once. He said, God is in love with matter. He created so much of it. And I like to think about the fact that to obey Jesus's teachings, 98% of Jesus' teachings can't be obeyed without a body. So disembodied life is not the goal. And so I think there is a spectrum to that. There is a spot where we are, you know, my sinful nature is just awful and terrible. I need to leave it behind. And then it moves to kind of the bumper sticker of Christians aren't perfect, just forgiven, which is kind of I don't like that, but it's also finally getting to the tension point. And then getting to the point of saying, my body, myself, is fearfully and wonderfully made and capable of some really wild, desperate, disordered kind of things. And so if we can begin to learn how to restrain the power of the body, not destroy it, not kick it aside, not throw it away, but we can learn how to harness and maintain and manage the power of our bodies and learn how to use them in a good way, but also have a sober understanding of it. Then that's where we start to experience freedom. But it takes us getting in the weeds with that. And that's where restlessness happens, is right in the middle of that whole discussion. And there are a lot of different implications of this. I was talking with someone yesterday about the idea of purity culture and the way that especially evangelical churches teach young women about sex. It is very much this whole the body is bad kind of line of thinking. And it's statistically, we're finding that to be counterproductive at best, destructive at worst.
Well, I wanted to shift to one more deep dive area. And for listeners of this, there's so much that I could have picked from to dive into here, but this is just a taste test. You'll have to get the book to see what I'm speaking of. But you wrote on page 38, our relationship to the divine is built on the metaphor of attachment. And I wanted to talk about some of the things you were speaking of, detachment as seen as non-attachment, and then this process that we go through in formation that's a posture. You say on page 35, attachment, detachment, and reattachment. I really appreciated that that sort of process of thinking through how we have our relationships, even any relationship or going through life, but also with the divine and what it means to be attached, but then not attached to all these fixed things about God and what it has to look like and what God has to mean to us, and be able to detach and then reattach and continue to grow. So you mentioned that mystery allows for the process of detachment and reattachment to be ongoing as we grow. So maybe just whatever you'd like to speak to that would be helpful.
Yeah. Oh, that's something I desperately want to know more about. I sort of wrote about the tip of the iceberg for me. I feel like that discussion is very helpful. And I give all the credit for this to Dr. Renita Weems, is someone that I quote in the book. There's an image she used that was really helpful, but I found her information in another wonderful book by Barbara Peacock called Soul Care and African American Practice. That is wonderful. It's a wonderful book. But Dr. Weems talks about the image of a bed, and she talks about how the bed is made with, you know, sheets and blankets and pillows and everything that goes on it. And that imagery for me is about attachment. So if you looked at the sheets as your attachment to yourself, the blanket as your attachment to other people, and the pillows as your attachment to God, as we begin our life, we make our bed. So we have images and understandings of God. We have ways of seeing and understanding ourselves. And then we have ways of connecting and being with other people, and we attach to those. And they begin to give us meaning. They begin to shape how we see the world, how we see other people. In our attachment to God, we attach to a faith community. So these things are all integrated too. We attach to God in a particular community, and that community gives us boundaries and concrete, this is who we are and this is who they are. And then it also teaches us about ourselves. This is who you are. This is how you carry yourself and conduct yourself. And so we have this nicely made bed, and we have all these attachments that we live by. And then the process of growth, and I would even say, I don't know if this will be controversial. It might be, but I'll explain it. Well, maybe that will make it better. I would even say that the idea of sanctification, of being set aside and being changed and being transformed and shaped, I would even say it requires what's about to happen, which is moving from our attachments to where we detach from those. So if you took it from strictly a family systems idea, a child grows up attached to their family, their morals, their values, their place in geography and all of that, the traditions and everything. And then they move out and they begin to form different attachments, and they begin to let go of some of the other attachments so that they can go move on and begin to cultivate their own life. And so they detach from some of those other things. And so Dr. Weems talks about how when we do that, we unmake the bed. We pull off the pillows, and we detach from that previous connection with God or way of connecting with God. We blankets, sheets, the whole thing. What's left is the frame and the mattress, which to me is that big B belonging. It's that stuff that never changes. But if we leave it that way, you're not going to sleep again. The goal is then to begin to make new attachments, to reattach to certain things. So new metaphors, new ways of seeing God, new communities, new senses of ourself, new sense of how we relate to others. And that process cycles through. We go through that constantly over and over again. Where restlessness happens is when we're staring at the unmade bed. And we know, I cannot put those pillows back on there. I can't live with that image of God anymore. I grew up with this judgmental, terrifying view of God that just is, you know, God is the abusive father and Jesus is sort of standing in between us, holding him back and restraining his fury and wrath. I can't sleep with those pillows on the bed anymore, but I have no idea what do I need now? What are the things that I need to attach to in order to have a faith? Because for the most part, even despite what gets said about deconstruction and reconstruction, a lot of people do not want to leave their faith behind, capital F. They want to leave behind the lowercase f, a form of faith, a way of doing faith. They don't want to leave the whole thing. But when they're not presented with an option, when detachment and reattachment is not given as an option, when it's either this or nothing, the nothing is the only choice we can make, because restlessness won't let us go back. And some people do go back, and typically what happens is they become a form of a modern day Pharisee, because they're just trying to live hard enough to where it will finally work again. And I don't find that that happens very often. I just painted with a very large, wide, generalizing brush, but there is some, I think there's some value to that, that idea.
Mm. Yeah. And I think for people within the Christian community, we see this, generally speaking, we see this big peeling away in Protestantism and specifically in evangelicalism and this rise of the nuns, N-O-N-E-S. And a lot of people have done a lot of hand-wringing that means that the church is collapsing and that Christianity is collapsing. And then you hear from others who say, well, maybe this is actually a refining and an evolution of what Christianity could be and what faith can be in a more authentic form that isn't going to get caught up in the weeds of politics and power and all this stuff. We're kind of in a flux period for sure of how Christianity, and at least in the United States, I'm speaking of the United States right now, of course, because every country has its own process and journey. But I think with the thing that I've spoken to people about that are outside of that bubble, which there are many and maybe most people, is that the thing that Karen Armstrong has said, which is that we learn about God or some kind of concept about God often when we learn about Santa Claus, and then our idea of Santa Claus matures, but our idea of God for some reason doesn't. And we stay with this infantile idea of God and then get all mad about it when it turns out to be not true. But we're thinking of God like a toddler might, like, why did God do this to me? And why isn't this fair? And it's like a temper tantrum. And we wouldn't be upset that Santa Claus doesn't live at the North Pole, because that's something a toddler would think, right? And so as I've expressed this to people who are outside Christianity, but know about God, know about Christianity, have some formation with it, but haven't ever been in that evangelical bubble like I was as a pastor's kid and going to Christian camp and all the rest. Most of the time when I say that, there is this glimmer of recognition, like, you know what, I maybe didn't even think of it like that, and I maybe need to revisit what I think about God as a adult. Like, what could that mean? It probably doesn't mean Zeus on a throne throwing lightning bolts, you know. Like, would that be silly if I thought that? Like, because I'm a grown adult, I'm not going to think of cartoons when I think of God. And just being okay with, it's okay to change your mind and evolve as you grow up. And as you are exposed to new things that give you a wider perspective, it is okay to let go of childish ways and childish thinking.
Well, and it's also okay to have developed those childish ways of thinking. Just because becoming a part of a new community necessarily means some kind of differentiation. And so how that happens can be, you know, eventually can be destructive or damaging. But the first step of a person who comes to, you know, whether it's Christian faith or any other religion's faith, the first step is really to say, this is who we are, this is who they are, this is how you set yourself apart. And so that differentiation leads to belonging, a kind of belonging or a kind of membership. But eventually that fades away. And I see it sort of in the ways, I hate math, but this is the best example I can give. When we were teaching my daughter math when she was young, and we said, okay, so 5 - 1 = 4. And she's like, okay, what is 1 - 5? And we said, well, you can't do that, because that would leave you with a number that you're not ready to know how to deal with yet. Now, of course, at some point she had to start understanding negative numbers and say, yes, you can subtract 5 from 1 and you get -4. That's the extent of my math skills right there that I just told you. So I used every tool in the toolbox for that. But that grows, that changes over time. We taught her early on, don't talk to strangers. But if she's going to get a job or get married or conduct business, at some point she's going to have to talk to somebody she doesn't know. And so that growth aspect of it is sometimes easier to slip back into, especially in times of pain and crisis. And so I think there is a bit of compassion when we go back to those early, we slide back into those early stage spiritualities when we're suffering and say, why, God, why would you do this to me? And instead we're welcomed into detaching from the idea that God, that that's who God is, or that God caused this. Or how do we see evil? Is it black, white, good, bad, in, out? Bad thing happened because I didn't do good thing, or because I did bad thing. And so when that non-dual way of seeing the world begins to emerge, that's where restlessness really starts to kick in. And we struggle the most to sit in the middle of that, because it's challenging our default ways of seeing everything.
Right. And I would say it's a spectrum. Restlessness might be on the nice end of it. And then on the other end would be crisis, right? It would be like a total crisis of faith or whatever. And it can run the whole spectrum, which is as you speak to this, it is a great segue for the last bit that I was interested in speaking about, but not sure we would have the time, which is where you speak about forgiveness around page 103, around that area in your book. And you write that forgiveness prompts us. And when I speak about forgiveness, I'm talking about like forgiving the people who told us things that don't work anymore or are confusing now, and forgiving ourselves for believing them or even being restless and confused. And you write, forgiveness prompts us to decenter our ego and our need for vindication, believing that true vengeance offers no return on investment. Instead, we can try to step into the place of our enemy and see the world from their perspective. And I would love for you to talk about mending and forgiveness, a little taste of what you offer in the book.
Yeah. This is such an area of work. I almost want to have an inner monologue with myself and go, why did you bother writing a chapter on forgiveness? It's not anything that I feel like I've become an expert at. I think a lot of what I have come to know about it has been from watching our responses, people's responses to, and my own responses to being wounded or being the one who has wounded someone else. And I think it starts, for me, it starts with this very human notion that forgiveness is one of the most compelling stories in humanity. For a person to be hurt to whatever extent, and then to release their wounder or their offender from guilt, not consequences, but to release them from guilt. When stories like that happen on the news, they're the ones that we watch and we talk about and we share. I think of the incident several years ago in Nickel Mines where a man walked into a school and shot several children from an Amish community, I believe. And just that community's response of forgiving that person and grieving with that person's family. And I remember just being so captivated by that. And so that on the one hand, we're so compelled by that story. And then on the other hand, so we transition then into the things that have happened to us and the person who's wounded us. And really, truthfully, we just think it's an absurd idea that that will ever be mended. And so we live in this tension between this is the most beautiful story the world has ever seen, and I'm pretty sure it's absurd that it will ever happen. That's the restless tension that comes when we think about mending the world or forgiveness, is there is a desire for it, but there's also just a cynicism about the possibility of it. And so to sit in between those two things, I can't not be wounded, or I can't take back the wounding that I've done. And yet to think that this would actually be mended, that this could actually be better than it is right now between my child or spouse or parent or whatever, to think that that's actually possible seems absurd to me. And I think that's the sort of the wild beast and the angels kind of place. It would be so nice if we could just, if we could set this aside, if we could mend this moment, if we could mend the situation. And yet I have a feeling that there are snarling beasts on the other side of that door, that if I go through it, I might be hurt again. If I go through it, maybe I'll be disappointed that things, I put myself out there and things did not go back to normal. I asked for forgiveness and didn't receive it. And I think there's so much learning to be done in between that compelling story and the feeling that it's absurd. And I see that in the story, in one of the stories in the Gospels where Peter asked Jesus, how many times do I have to forgive someone who's wounded me? I love that story. I really do, because it just is so human. Like, okay, so how many boxes do I really have to check before I can totally write this person off? Because I think that's what he was thinking. I don't know. I can't put myself back in his brain, but just looking at the rest of Peter's life, I'm like, that sounds like a Peter thing to do. Okay, when am I done? When am I done with forgiveness? And when can I just give in to this cynicism and the feeling that it's absurd anyway? And Jesus's answer is, you know, depending on translation, 70 times or 70 times seven, whichever it is, it's just an absurd number. And so the point is, you're kind of never done with that. It's not so much a thing you do. It's a posture you have to take. It's a way that you take of seeing the world that, yes, the world can be mended. And yes, it does seem absurd. And living right there is where you learn and where you grow the most. And I found that to be true in me as well. That's the only way we can, I feel like we can forgive someone of the guilt of what has happened and not let, but not change the, you know, not take away the consequences of it. Someone who physically abuses someone, you can forgive them the guilt of what they've done over time. And it could be day to day. I mean, some days you wake up and you're like, I've let that person off the hook. And the next day you wake up and you're like, I would love for terrible things to happen to them. And you sort of ebb and flow with that. But I would never say to someone who's been through that, I think you need to be back in that person's life. Like, there are just consequences that come with it. And I think it's very hard for us to live spiritually healthy in between the guilt and the consequences if we haven't figured out how to really embrace the restlessness of the whole thing. It's unsettling to me that I was wounded, but it's also unsettling to me that I can't have that relationship back. That can't ever be the same. And so you could take an extreme example like physical abuse, but you could also take another example like people who over time have used their words. I see this with kids and their parents, adult children with their parents, and their parents have used words over time to wound them and passive aggressiveness and all that. And what they do is say, I forgive you for what that's done to me, but this is, you're not going to be a part of my life with that. Or my children's life with that. And so they put up boundaries, and usually that is not well received. Sometimes it is, but it's typically not well received. So the mending of the world is lived out between our hope in forgiveness and our cynicism that it might happen. And that, I feel like that's the only way through, is just to admit that those are both parts of it.
Well, for everyone, Casey has written a book called The Gift of Restlessness, A Spirituality for Unsettled Seasons. Can you tell people where they can find you online?
Yeah, my website is caseytigrett.com, just my name. Or there's other work that I do as a spiritual director with a group called Soul Care. We walk with people in restless seasons, and you can find out more about that on soulcare.com. But those are two good places to find what I'm up to.
Well, this has been a real treat. And so thank you for coming on the podcast. And I wish you the best with this wonderful book.
Thanks, Lisa. You've been so gracious to have me on. I appreciate it.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.